This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, June 24, 2005. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Iraqi Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari is in Washington meeting with President Bush. A severe heat wave in India has killed at least 700, mostly poor residents, over the past few weeks. And it's been nearly 6 months since a tsunami hit Asian and African countries. We'll hear about the relief efforts in Thailand. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Leanne Caldwell, and these are the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Voter turnout in Iran's runoff election is high, but the outcome is too close to call. Saida Jamshidi reports.
The two candidates, former President Hashemi Rafsanjani and former Tehran Mayor Ahmadinejad, are running neck and neck. In his last debate before deadline on Thursday, Ahmadinejad had argued that many people telling him that he had entered the red line dominated by authority. He said he wouldn't intimidate by these kind of saying. He would fight corruption and discrimination. Ahmadinejad has promoted to return to the revolution values and shut down several Western-style fast food restaurants. On the other hand, Mr. Rafsanjani, who considered as a pragmatic cleric open to wider views, says he wants to open up the society so that people won't be afraid to express their opinion. Rafsanjani is open to negotiation with the West, specifically with the United States. He said if the United States is sincere with their cooperation and working with Iran, they would like to have relationships. Hundreds of reformist political groups and activists have asked people vote for Mr. Rafsanjani. They believe that Rafsanjani is closer to their political views than Ahmadinejad. I am Saida Jamshidi, Tehran, for Free Speech Radio News.
Sri Lanka's government signed a controversial tsunami aid sharing deal with Tamil Tigal rebels, despite stiff opposition from the Marxists who stalled a parliamentary debate on the issue. Poonia Manikavasagam has a story from Sri Lanka.
Protesters marched in hundreds towards the parliament, and the police used tear gas to disperse the crowd. Under the deal, the government and the Tamil Tigers would jointly handle billions of dollars in foreign aid for survivors of the December 26th tsunami. At least 31,000 people were killed and a million displaced by the tidal waves. The Buddhist extremists and the Marxists blame the joint administrative power with the rebels would lead the Tigers to establish a separate state in a small island nation. The government postponed the parliament until July 5th to respond to the MPs of the Marxist GVP who blocked the debate on the scheduled post-tsunami operational management structure, or the PTOMS, in the morning. The government had secret talks with the Tamil Tiger rebels through the peace broker Norway to arrive at an agreement. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Ponnaiya Manikavasagam from Vaunia, Sri Lanka.
A major street battle erupted yesterday on the outskirts of Mexico City at a time when municipal authorities are contemplating the implementation of a massive security operation throughout the metropolitan area. Shannon Young files this report.
Over 2,000 police participated in an operation to recuperate an ecological reserve that had been occupied by the Francisco Villa Independent Popular Front, a Mexico City-based organization composed of homeless and urban poor. The group has a history of confronting Mexico City housing issues by occupying empty buildings and lands and then negotiating permanent residence. In this case, negotiations between the Pancho Villas and Mexico City's government broke down. Riot police with horses and dogs then built up a security perimeter around the disputed terrain, while the Pancho Villas dug trenches and erected barricades. Press reports from the scene yesterday describe a violent confrontation that erupted when police tried to dislodge the Pancho Villas using heavy loads of tear gas. The occupants responded with rocks and Molotov cocktails. An estimated 40 minutes of street battle ensued, with the terrain left empty. The makeshift wooden and cardboard homes built by the Pancho Villas were then demolished with bulldozers. This morning, Mexico City's government identified at least a dozen other disputed lands slated for similar evictions. For FSRN, this is Shannon Young in Oaxaca.
Inmates in prisons around Ecuador are protesting extended sentencing guidelines and prison conditions through hunger strikes and self-mutilation. Inmates in Guayaquil and Quito are sewing their lips shut and burying themselves up to their necks. They are rejecting a law that the Congress annulled in 2001 that shortened sentences. They also demand better treatment in prisons with no clean water, no electricity, no medical treatment, and overcrowded conditions. The United States is pressing the United Nations to stop paying into China's population fund because they say Beijing is using the money to promote abortion. Haider Rizvi has more from the UN.
This week, at a closed-door meeting of the UN Fund for Population, also known as UNFPA, a U.S. representative bluntly criticized China for its one-child policy. She also accused China of using the UN Population Fund to implement its policy of forced abortions. She said Washington would stop funding the agency until China reverses its policy on abortions. But both the UN officials and Chinese diplomats strongly denied these charges by arguing that the family planning programs in China were producing positive results. A Chinese diplomat said, in the absence of a comprehensive family planning program, the population in his country would have grown by 300 million additional people in the past 30 years, which equals the entire U.S. population. UNFPA says, in the next 5 years, it will be spending about $27 million in China, which is less than 3% of what the Chinese government puts into its population program. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
And I'm Leanne Caldwell for Free Speech Radio News.
Iraqi Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari met with President Bush today at the White House. Afterwards, they addressed reporters. Mitch Jezerich has more from Washington.
You don't have to worry, Mr. Prime Minister, about timetables.
President Bush assured Iraqi Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari that U.S. troops in Iraq would be staying put.
Our troops will continue to train Iraqi security forces so these forces can defend their country and to protect their people from terror. And as Iraqis become more capable in defending their nation, our troops will eventually return home with the honor they have earned.
There is some talk on Capitol Hill that President Bush should lay out a timeline for leaving Iraq. And on Thursday, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Armed Services Committee, Carl Levin of Michigan, suggested that the president should threaten to pull out of Iraq if the Iraqi government fails to complete a constitution by February. Prime Minister Jafari says that since the fall of Saddam Hussein, Iraq has met every deadline it has faced.
So many people said that democracy will never stand in Iraq, said that elections will never be held in Iraq, and they said also that the government will never be established in Iraq, and they said that there would be no constitution, but everything will be there, and the whole world will see that changes in Iraq happen because of the great will of the people of Iraq and the countries that are assisting us.
Staff Sergeant Terry Wayne Hemingway, Staff Sergeant Ryan Augusto Tejeda.
In the House of Representatives on Thursday night, several lawmakers took an hour to read all the names of the some 1,700 U.S. soldiers who have died in Iraq. Today, another six soldiers were killed and 13 were injured by a car bomb that exploded in the Iraqi city of Fallujah. President Bush is urging the U.S. people not to let the continuing carnage diminish its support for his efforts there.
Richard Allen Goward.
The carnage that they wreak will be on TV. And they know that it bothers people to see death. And it does. It bothers me. It bothers American citizens. It bothers Iraqis. They're trying to shake our will.
Several recently published polls suggest that public support for Bush's war effort in Iraq are slipping. One poll said that under 40% of the people surveyed supported Bush's policies there. Prime Minister Jafari says that polls shouldn't dictate policy.
For the maintenance of democracy in Iraq and to remove the dictatorship, we do not forget those who stood beside us at hard times, and they are decided to go forward. And there is a lot of difference between 1 month and another, between 1 week and another. Iraqi people are insistent on going along the path of their economy and their security. But we do need the help of other countries who help us to stand beside us.
The Bush administration is using Jafari's visit, along with the president's national address next Tuesday, as part of a public relations strategy to ebb the country's uneasiness about Iraq. Its message is simple. Continued support is needed for the survival of an Iraqi government that was put into place through elections.
I think there's no good option. I don't think that a U.S. withdrawal would instantly bring peace and prosperity to the country.
Chris Tosing, the director of the Middle East Research and Information Project, says he doesn't think a U.S. withdrawal would end all the violence in Iraq, but he does support a plan to withdraw because he says the U.S. presence there is what is inciting the most violence.
The largest part of the insurgency in terms of manpower is motivated, I think, primarily by the presence of foreign troops on their soil and by the perception on their part that there is no end in sight to the presence, to that foreign presence on their soil.
Anti-war organizations are organizing a national demonstration for September 24th, calling for an end to the U.S. presence in Iraq. Mitch Jezrich, Free Speech Radio News.
A severe heat wave in India has killed at least 700 people over the past few weeks. Most of the victims have been the poor, peasant farmers, elderly people, three-wheeler pullers, and street vendors who succumbed to heat stroke and dehydration in temperatures that reached 130 degrees Fahrenheit. What makes things worse in some parts of north and eastern India are the terrain changes resulting from the mining industry's practice. Vinod K. Jose files this report from Odisha, India.
Heat has become hard to beat in North India. The unofficial death toll due to heat stroke is 700. Those in the most danger are people who have no option but to be out in the heat. Meena Kumari is a construction worker. She carries stones and bricks 10 hours a day in the scorching heat with no protection.
Whatever the temperature may be, we've got to be out in the sun working to earn our bread and butter.
It is people like Meena Kumari who succumb to heat stroke and dehydration. Poverty and scarcity of clean water makes the conditions worse. Parts of North and Eastern India is rich in coal, iron ore and diamond deposits. Talcher is one such town in Orissa, India's western state. It is part of the 1800 square kilometer coal belt owned by the government. Mukesh Sahu is a resident of Talcher.
It is hard for us to live here. We're dying in the heat. We're facing the fury of temperature ever since the mining industries came into our town. The heat is increasing every year.
The mined coal deposits catch fire during heat waves, raising the temperature of the surrounding area even further. People unanimously blame the open-cast mining for the unusual rise in temperature. Ram Kumar is one such local.
It is all because of the mindless mining. The administration is lying to us. They say the temperature is 130 degrees Fahrenheit, but the actual temperature is much more than what they tell us.
10,000 hectares of forest cover has been destroyed by the mining companies over the years in this small town alone. Reforestation measures required by law have not yet taken place, and now Talcher looks like a desert. Rick Ram is an environmentalist who lives in Talcher.
There has been no scientific study into the rising temperature of this district. The administration is not even bothering to plant vegetation here. The mining destroyed the thick vegetation we had here, which once contained the heat waves.
The monsoon wind has hit south of the country, but it might take few more days for it to reach the north. People here are desperately waiting for a good rain as an urgent remedy. But next summer, it will be the repetition of the same story until the locals and environmentalists start organizing themselves. From India, I'm Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
It's been nearly 6 months since the December 26 earthquake and tsunami hit Asian and African countries, killing hundreds of thousands of people. One of the countries hardest hit was Thailand. Almost 5,400 people were killed in six southern provinces just off the Andaman Sea coast. Nearly half of the dead were foreign tourists visiting the resort islands of Phuket and Koh Phi Phi. Nearly 3,000 people are still missing. FSRN reporter Diwali Saikotau traveled back to some of the tsunami-affected areas in Thailand and files this report.
The waves are too rough for swimming on this day in Patong Beach. The sky is gray and it feels like it's about to pour buckets of rain. Random tourists pass each other by quietly as Thai beach workers look on. They stare mostly at each other, praying for more tourists. Jet ski operator Surian Launan has worked on this beach for 10 years. He was here when the tsunami hit. On that day, he lost two relatives and some close friends who worked on the beach. Not only did he lose family and friends, but if tourists fail to return, he may lose his livelihood too.
Now it's very bad because before tsunami, this business, the tourists like to do more than 75%, but now less than 25%.
Tourism has suffered as would be expected after such a tragedy. However, to many, the slowdown appears to be worse than expected. The Tourism Authority of Thailand, or TAT, says more than 19 international airline carriers have cancelled or dropped flights to Phuket International Airport through October. At least 10 airlines have suspended flights to this region indefinitely. Anoma Vongyai is with the TAT office in Phuket.
If no tourists, that means local people very hard to survive their life because main occupation here is related in tourism industries.
She said Phuket is open for business and that her office is working hard to promote Phuket as the top tourism destination that it once was. The worst hit areas are north of Phuket in Phang Nga province. Those who survived the tsunami there are now trying to get through the economic impacts of it. Locals complain that government aid has been slow to arrive. Many say they have been thankful to private and international aid groups who have helped to provide temporary shelters, food and counseling. Salisa Pet Noi of Action Aid in Bangkok said all the basic support has been provided for tsunami victims in Thailand and 80% of housing has been finished. Their group's main focus, she said, is on long-term support like vocational training or evaluating the emotional state of people in affected areas. Chalam Kiet Ong Chalong is president of a rescue foundation in Phuket called Khun Satam Mulanithi. He says his team helped to save hundreds of lives during the tsunami. 6 months on, he says his group is ready to help people in case of a future disaster, but there are concerns.
Tsunami
is the worst experience for us as rescue workers. We had little or no equipment searching for bodies inside of crumbling buildings. We need to solve this problem to get the Thai government to help us if the tsunami comes back.
Thailand has set up a national early warning system for its coastline. Tsunami watchtowers with sirens have been installed, and several evacuation drills have already taken place in the tsunami-affected provinces. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Dwahli Saikautau in Phuket, Thailand.
In the shadow of the February 2005 assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri, people across Lebanon went to the polls last Sunday in the last of five rounds of regional voting for the parliamentary elections in Lebanon. With the voter turnout estimated by most observers to be between 40 and 50%, Saad Hariri of the Future Movement and son of the slain former Prime Minister led the opposition bloc to a majority in the Lebanese parliament. In Beirut, Lebanon, FSRN Stefan Christoph provides this post-election report.
Lebanon's opposition coalition now holds a 72-seat majority in Lebanon's parliament. The backbone of the opposition campaign was the political energy following the major street demonstrations between February and April sparked by Hariri's death. The wave of street demonstrations in 2005, like the opposition's election campaign, was rooted in the demand for the removal of upwards of 15,000 Syrian troops from Lebanon. The opposition, led by Saad Hariri, grouped together traditionally opposing political parties, including the Progressive Socialist Party, representing Lebanon's Druze Muslim community, former representatives of the Lebanese Falangists responsible for the 1982 Palestinian massacre of Sabra and Shatila, and the newly formed left-leaning Democratic Left Movement. All of these groups united to call for an end to the Syrian military and intelligence presence in Lebanon. FSRN spoke with Minra Shidraoui of the Democratic Left Movement.
The first thing we called for is a democratic Lebanon with no hegemony from anyone, regardless if it's Syrians, if it's Americans, if it's French, if it's Saudis. we want a free Lebanon. So definitely when you find somebody who's been in your country for 30 years and running your country as if it's backyard, definitely if you're a leftist or not a leftist, it's something that will touch you.
Lebanon's political system is based on sectarian distribution of power among religious communities in the country. Currently, the 128 seats in Lebanon's parliament are divided in half between Christians and Muslims. The current sectarian system was reinstated by the Taif Accord, which brought an end to the 15-year Lebanese civil war in 1990. A grassroots campaign emerged during the recent elections called Hayya Binna, Let's Go in Arabic, that called on people to protest the last round of parliamentary elections. Lachman Slim of Hayya Binna explains.
We had a lot of reservation concerning the way the opposition seemed to manage the electoral issue. We called voters to go voting by using cancelled ballots to make their protestation active. We asked them to use a cancelled ballot, and the cancelled ballot was constituted of a slogan very easy to be understood in the Lebanese context. It's 64 plus 64 equals zero.
Grassroots activists in Lebanon say that the 2005 street demonstrations after Hariri's death were co-opted by the opposition, which in words called for political change in the country, but in reality participated in maintaining the same sectarian political system within Lebanon. Activists like Afamia Kadour of the Beirut Independent Media Center see a need to reform Lebanon's electoral system.
To make it based on relative representation, because this way you would give voice to people who are, who don't have the same power or the money to run against people like Saad al-Hariri or Walid Jumblat. I don't think the change can happen overnight. And because there is no political will to change the current system. And everybody who's in power now, the current political system is beneficial to them. So they don't have political will to change it. So the people who would like to make the change are outside of all this equation.
The recent elections in Lebanon reinstated many of the same faces and families in parliament. These are people who maintained power prior to Syria's withdrawal in April 2005. This is Stefan Christoph reporting for FSRN in Beirut, Lebanon.
The House of Representatives restored the $100 million originally proposed to be cut from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, or CPB, yesterday. Though the move restores the CPB's funding, another $102 million from other public broadcast programs for basic equipment purchases was not restored. This CPB funding is part of a larger bill that includes a nearly $6 billion cut to federal health, education, and labor departments. The cuts to health care pose a challenge to many state governors at a time of increased unemployment. Tennessee Governor Phil Bredesen is in Washington, D.C. today presenting his strategy. Reem Katkuda of the D.C. Radio Co-op reports.
Imagine that you're shopping for groceries at the grocery store.
His office in Nashville, Tennessee, is occupied for the fifth consecutive day in a continuous vigil in the face of what they call, quote, the largest cuts in health care in the United States history.
You never see the amounts, you never see the total, your wallet.
Thousands from across the state have rallied in Nashville twice in the last 6 months, denouncing Phil Bredesen's planned cuts into TennCare, the state's health care assistance program.
But this is exactly the way our health care system works.
Yet, Phil Bredesen, a potential presidential candidate in 2008, is in Washington, D.C., trying to convince other governors and the press that his recipe for handling health care needs should be followed. The health care cuts that Bredesen recommends include refusing benefits to some 323,000 people and limiting prescription drugs, doctor's visits, lab, x-rays, and hospital visits and services, and eliminating private duty nursing and convalescent care to all. The concerns of TennCare recipients from Tennessee were brushed off as unrealistic by the governor, despite a request for candid honesty voiced by Ron Pollack of Families USA, a healthcare consumers advocacy group based in Washington, D.C.
Your speech just now was extraordinarily misleading because you totally underplayed the tremendous change that you're trying to implement in Tennessee. 396,000 people are going to lose benefits, and everybody else is going to get health care determined by state bureaucrats, not by their physicians.
Polak adds that the worst cuts to come will be in the budget reconciliation process scheduled for around September, where $10 billion cuts are expected from Medicare. For Free Speech Radio News, reporting from Washington, D.C., I'm Reem Katkhuda.
A growing scandal over dirty computer recycling operations at a prison in California has spread to facilities across the country. According to one whistleblower, the scandal may be behind the resignation of a high-level official at the Federal Bureau of Prisons. From KPFA in Berkeley, Brian Edwards-Tiekert has the story.
When Atwater Prison opened its computer recycling operation 3 years ago, safety manager Leroy Smith was concerned about prisoners smashing computer monitors.
They actually break it with like a 3 or 4 pound hammer, and they'll break the gun off the top of the monitor, and then they'll break the rest of the glass.
Each monitor can contain up to 6 pounds of lead, as well as several other toxic metals. That had Smith worried about the dust that inmates and prison staff were breathing. He couldn't get Federal Prison Industries to do any testing, so he brought in an independent contractor.
What we found was that we exceeded the action level, permissible exposure limit level, and threshold level of lead and cadmium.
Smith says that means there should have been safeguards in place, respirators, protective clothing, and decontamination rooms to keep the dust from spreading out of the work area. But he says that when he pushed for those things, high-level staff attacked his work instead of addressing the problem. Later, he found elevated levels of barium in the blood of 3 workers and tried to temporarily close down the facility. He says the warden made veiled threats about Smith's wife, who also works at the prison. That's when he decided to go public, filing a complaint with OSHA and seeking whistleblower protection. Deanne Amadon is a spokesperson for the United States Department of Labor. She says OSHA inspected the prison at the end of March, but couldn't substantiate any of Smith's allegations, including the charge that the prison was serving inmates food in the contaminated work area.
The investigation found that at the time we were on site, the inmates as well as the guards in the area had personal protective gear that they were using properly, that probably some changes had been made.
In other words, Amadon thinks the prison may have cleaned up for the inspectors, who announced in advance when they'd be coming. Smith and others think they've only scratched the surface at Atwater Prison. At least 7 other federal prisons run computer recycling programs, and since Smith went public, staff at many of them have started to come forward. Jeff Ruck is the Director of Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, which he describes as a battered staff shelter for whistleblowers.
In some of the prisons, the staff went home covered with dust to their families, and that dust consists of hazardous materials. They didn't know, and just now they're beginning to ask questions of the authorities.
The Department of Justice is now investigating Leroy Smith's whistleblower complaint, but refused to comment for this story. Stephen Tussey, the National Safety Administrator for the Federal Prison System, has just abruptly stepped down. In a letter to his staff, he wrote that his goal was to make life easier for safety personnel in prisons, but, quote, "With the constraints of politics, policy, and protocol, I'm not sure I met my goal very often."
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert in Berkeley.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.